Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Journey to Success Radio Network. Our purpose on Journey to Success Radio is to interview people who are making a positive difference in this world. We explore important aspects and areas of life, including business, sales, physical, mental, relationships, disabilities, and many more interesting topics. Our broadcast team consists of several outstanding people from both Canada and the U.S., including several Napoleon Hill certified instructors, as well as several authors. My name is Tom Tuttle Cunningham. I'm a Napoleon Hill Foundation certified instructor. I'm also a regular contributor to their weekly newsletter. And in March of 2012, I spoke at the Napoleon Hill International Convention in Malaysia, where I shared the stage with Deepak Chopra, who was a keynote speaker at that event. I've had rheumatoid arthritis from my jaw to my toes since the age of 5. That's 44 years now. And in that time, I've had 4 hips, 4 knees, and 2 shoulders replaced, and I've been hospitalized about 40 times. I also stand about 5'1", and that's due to the heavy daily doses of the oral steroid prednisone that I had to take to fight my arthritis. And despite those physical challenges, I'm well known for always answering amazing when asked how I'm doing. I'm also a senior research director for the Canadian Business Journal. We're a digital-only publication, and we're the official and only media partner of the Canadian Chamber of Commerce. You can find out more about me at my website. It's mrpma.ca. That's mrpma.ca. My guest today is Spencer West. Spencer is number 41 on my list of 101 things to do before I die. I prepared this list about 2 or 3 weeks ago, thinking of people I wanted to meet, and Spencer ends up number 41 on my list, and I haven't even completed the list yet. Spencer is an inspirational and charismatic speaker. He talks candidly about the struggles he overcame after losing his legs at the age of 5. He speaks about overcoming stereotyping and bullying, about finding meaning and happiness in a material world, and how he never lost the hope or courage he needed to mount personal obstacles. Infused with humor and humility, his thought-provoking message inspires people to find opportunity in every challenge. With every speech, Spencer leaves an indelible mark on his audiences, instilling hope and strong leadership so they can inspire others to create positive change. In 2008, Spencer traveled to Kenya on an international volunteer trip where he helped build a school in a rural community in the country. And on this trip, he met young people who strive to overcome challenges every day. And he credits that experience for helping him recognize his true calling, what we call his definite purpose, which is to motivate and inspire people around the world. Last year, Kenya experienced its worst drought in 60 years, and its effects are still being felt. In its time of need, Spencer decided to give back in his own unique way by climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. His extraordinary feat attracted worldwide media attention, including CTV, CBS, The Telegraph, People Magazine, and the BBC. And with the world watching, Spencer successfully reached the summit of Kilimanjaro, raising over $500,000 to bring sustainable, clean water projects in communities affected by the drought. Before joining the Me to We speaker, Spencer was on the Go Global speaking tour for Free the Children. And through a keynote address and leadership workshop, Spencer encouraged youth to overcome daily challenges, believe in themselves as active change makers, and find personal strength to fight for issues they are passionate about. His words have encouraged millions of young people to become more socially involved in their communities and the world. Spencer shares his incredible story with the world in his memoir, Standing Tall, My Journey. Welcome to the show today, Spencer.
Thank you so much, Tom. I'm so excited. That was like the longest intro ever. I'm a bit embarrassed, I have to be honest.
It wouldn't do you justice if I didn't do that full intro. And as I said, I read a book called The Business of Happiness by Ted Leonsis, which you may want to read about. In there, he has a project that he talks about the same kind of thing, clean water in third world countries. I think it's where kids ride on something. Kids ride on a device which powers, like kind of a playground device, which powers a pump which delivers the clean water for the village. I think it might be called Play Pump. But anyway, he challenged people to write a list of 101 things to do before they died to help them with their happiness. And I was writing my list down, and I started thinking of people I want to meet. And movie stars and famous people don't interest me, but people like yourself. And we're both in Toronto, so it won't be too hard for us to get this done.
Absolutely, Tom, thank you. That's so humbling, and I'm so honored to even be thought of. So thank you for that. And yeah, let's make sure we make that happen.
Amazing. And so now you lost your legs at the age of 5. I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis at the age of 5. Tell me a little bit about that time. Were you discouraged? Was it just thinking of about it is unnerving for me. Did you have a great family? Did you have, you know, great parents? What was your situation, and what was the experience at the time when you're 5 years old?
Yeah, you know, so I was born with a genetic disease that caused the muscles not to work. And, you know, we ended up going to the Shriners Hospital because my parents were ready to have a family, but they weren't ready to have a child, you know, that was going to need life-changing surgery. So, you know, thanks to the incredible support of the Shriners Hospital, we were able to start looking at options and what we could do. So I had 2 surgeries. One was at the age of 2 where they removed my legs at the knee in hopes that I could use prosthetic legs and get around that way. But once we did that surgery, we realized that wasn't actually going to be the case. I wouldn't be able to use them. So then at the age of 5, they removed just below my pelvis. Now, you know, after my surgeries, and I want to preface this by saying I don't mean this to vilify the doctors in any way or make them sound like terrible people, because they were only giving us what they thought would be the best case scenario. But they told my parents that, you know, potentially I would never walk, I would never sit up on myself, and that I probably wouldn't be a functioning member of society. So for them to get me involved with, like, reading and writing and, you know, music and those sorts of things, but to be ready for a sedentary life. And, you know, that's where my parents are and were so incredible, is they said, we don't actually believe that. We think that he can be a functioning member of society, and there's so much more that we can do. So they chose to focus on what I could do instead of what I couldn't do. And, you know, that's where really everything started, was with them and them saying, like, well, no, that's fine, thank you for that, but we don't believe so. And this is what we see will happen, and we will go as far as we can. And, you know, my parents from the time that I was born have taught me to be independent and to take care of myself. My mom always said, because, you know, that's the one question I get a lot, like, why are you the way that you are? And it comes 100% from my parents. My mom said, you know, Spencer, your dad and I were afraid that if something were to happen to us, that you wouldn't be able to take care of yourself. And if we started to treat you differently, you would think you were different and you wouldn't take the risks you needed to become your own person. So I'm really grateful. And you know, when so many people ask, like, who are your inspirations, who are your heroes, my parents are always the first 2 people that I mention.
Amen. And this is, you're talking a little about my life story as well. My parents always let me do things. And in Canada, you know what things are included, like play hockey.
Yeah.
You know, you're a Canadian boy, you want to play hockey, you got arthritis. And my parents and I understood and agreed that, yes, tomorrow, after you play today, you will not be able to move. You'll be sore from head to toe. But you love hockey. You go play hockey. And, you know, we'll make sure we look after you tomorrow. And we met a lot of people in doctor's offices where the parents would not, you know, they put the kids like in a bubble and they didn't have a real life. And so I'm so grateful that they, like your parents, allowed me to do everything I needed to do, to be independent with the understanding, yeah, you can do the things you want to do. We know that you're going to be sore after and we'll look after you, but do what you love. We'll look after the arthritis afterwards. And so what a tremendous blessing. And a lot of people born in bad circumstances, they don't have the blessing of parents like that. And so, you know, people could say, oh, poor Spencer, but they can look at it and say, you know, wow, good for Spencer. He's got parents that can handle this. and that are going to make the best man out of him possible. So now at the age of five, and then in your bio, you talk about bullying. I got bullied a lot. I took growth injections when I was 16 to grow 6 inches, so I was like 4'6" before that. And, you know, girls would bully me. Boys bullying you, you think, okay, I'm a boy, and other boys bullying me. But when girls are teasing you because you're so short and you walk funny, it's easy for me to be so positive and strong and look back. But at the time, it's not pleasant, is it? And you must have experienced this as well, because kids are cruel. And, you know, I'm talking about myself, because I remember, you know, there was a nationality that we picked on when I was in high school, and, you know, I would participate just because they wouldn't be teasing me. So you must have got bullied a fair bit and teased, and what was that like, and how were you able to handle that when you're young?
Yeah, you know, it was a whole range of things. You know, it started in school, really, you know, where it would come time for gym class. And, you know, I was always the last person to be picked on a team, unless it was like dodgeball or hide and go seek, you know, and then everybody wanted to be on their team. But for the most part, it was like, oh, man, Spencer's on our team today. Well, I guess we're not going to win. You know, there was one student in particular who thought it was funny when I was going down the hall to grab the back of my wheelchair. So I would stop abruptly and my books would fall on the floor, and then I would tumble out after them. And you know, I tell that story, and at the time, I don't think he meant for that reaction to happen. And when I did tumble out of my wheelchair, he sort of bent down to help me, but then he didn't know what to do and panicked and ran away. So it's really interesting. And then when it came time for high school, you know, I grew up in the United States and in the state of Wyoming. And in my home state, and specifically my hometown, there was a big emphasis on you are not considered a good student unless you are good at academics and you play sports. I had the academics, no problem, but it was the sports piece. So I felt a lot of pressure to play a sport, because that's the one thing I've been teased for my entire life, is I always hung out with the girls. And so hanging out with the girls, I was teased a lot, you know, and my masculinity was questioned and all that sort of stuff. And so in high school, I thought, okay, well, I'm going to play sport then. So I tried out for the cheerleading squad, and I made the squad. And, you know, I had done gymnastics as a kid. My parents had got me in gymnastics, so it was great. I loved it. But now I was being teased by the boys for playing a sport. And I thought, well, now I'm doing what you told me to do, and now you're teasing me for that too, because I didn't play the right sport. So I was actually in that moment that I was like, I don't care anymore. I actually don't care, because I actually really enjoy this, and I don't care what you think. And that was a big turning point for me, where I started to recognize, oh, this entire time I've been trying to please everybody else and do what everybody else thinks that I should do, when instead I should have just been doing what I wanted to do. So I think that was a big turning point for me in high school. But on top of that, you know, because bullying is such a hot topic and it's something that is really being discussed now, for me, I was really grateful that I had a support system of people that I could talk to. My parents were great. I had some incredible friends that are still my friends today that I could talk to, who, once I started opening the dialogue with them, realized that we were all experiencing some of the same things. So for me, I mean, I found that really helpful. But the other thing, too, is that I didn't always do something about it. I just assumed it was always a part of growing up. And looking back, I wish I would have either said something to the person that was doing it to me, or I would have done something about it, because I was perpetuating that, like, it's okay.
Yeah, two tough things, because even I look back and like, should I have said some? Would it have been nasty?
Yeah.
And so it's tough. And bullying is an issue. And I'm glad you said what you said about reaching out. I assume almost everyone, especially ones being bullied, have at least one or two friends or family members. Parents are good. You know, you may not have parents that you could go to, which might be tough. You and I did, but parents are great, maybe siblings, friends, but, you know, talk it out. And why, you said something I've discovered as a big secret in life, is that sometimes you have bad feelings, but you think you're the only person who thinks like that. If you get in a group of people, you start talking about your bad feelings, people will be like, oh, I think like that too, and I thought I was the only one.
Yeah.
And so if you're being bullied, if you're going through that, talk about it to other people, people close to you, people going to support you, but don't be afraid to talk about it, because you'll find out that a lot of people get bullied, and there are maybe some strategies you can take on your own to cope with it and deal with it. And so, great topic, and as you mentioned, really topical topic. Another thing that I saw in your bio is infused with humor and humility. And I find that when I could progress the most when dealing with arthritis was when I could laugh at myself. When I can start making jokes about being short or not being able to pick things up off the ground or, you know, all the various funny things about being disabled, then I thought it, you know, would other people felt more comfortable, and I just felt better myself that, ha, 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 this is something I can make a joke about because it's really not affecting my life badly. And so did you always have this great sense of humor? Because people might be nervous around you. I imagine when you're in a room, people will be like, I want to go talk to that guy, but I don't know what to say. I'll feel uncomfortable.
Right. Yeah,
I was telling my coworkers today that I can't wait to meet him because I'm taller than him.
Exactly. And I was actually going to mention that. I'm like, well, you know, at least you found somebody that you are taller than.
Yes.
Yeah, humor has always been a big part of my family and my life. My dad is really, really funny, and his family is really funny, and my mom's side of my family just loved humor and jokes. So laughter has always been a big part of growing up. But it was also a way for me to break the ice, because the one thing that I've sort of noticed, and maybe you're someone in this case, is for me, it was hard to get people to recognize the humanity. Right away, they see that I don't have any legs, and that's the first thing that they want to know, which, you know, now being older, I understand, and I realize that we have to address that first before we can get past that, yeah, I don't have any legs, but, you know, my name is Spencer West, and I'm an author, and I'm a motivational speaker, and all those sorts of things that make up who we are. So what I discovered is if I could, when people asked where my legs were, I would start to make jokes about it to get them to realize that, like, hey, I'm a person, I have a name, let's start there, and then we can maybe talk about why I don't have any legs. So, you know, I would tell people I was, you know, I went to a magic show and they asked for a volunteer to be cut in half and I raised my hand, or, you know, I left with my other pants, or I typically tend to make a joke more when I'm speaking to adult audiences that, you know, I say, you know, let's address the elephant in the room and get the awkwardness out of the way that, you know, this is me high. So we break the ice, and then we can go into, because I feel like if you can get people to laugh, they can start to see past the differences and start to notice the similarities, or be like, oh yeah, this guy's a person, I, you know? And so
yeah.
I think humor for me has been the most important piece to being successful. And we also need
and
to
for
learn
people
to, laugh
to relate
at
to you as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I tell people all the time, I was reading about when you went to Kenya, and this is where you met some young people who strive to overcome challenges every day. And this is when you say, I answer amazing every time someone asks how I'm doing, and if you do that every day for 20-plus years, people are going to ask you why. So I tell them, like yourself, my mom and my sister went on medical missions to third world countries. And you know, in Canada, I've been in hospital 40 times. I've only ever paid to rent the TV I watch while I'm there. And so, you know, a reason I say amazing is because 40% of the world lives on less than $2 a day. They have no access to medical care like we do in Canada. And Spencer, I'm no nicer or more kind or more deserving to be born and raised in Canada than they are to be born and raised there. So you go to Kenya to build, what is it? Let me read this here. You were building a school. Now, I would not pick you on my school building team, but this is a big challenge. This is like, you must get all the low work. Like, you can paint the lower part of the wall or something, but this is kind of an interesting trip for you to take. Maybe people were asking you, are you crazy? And so while you're there, you meet people who are worse off than you, really, because you had great parents born in the U.S., so you had a good country to live in. And so these people are worse off than you, if other people can imagine someone being worse off than you. What inspired you about those people? And in Napoleon Hill's Success Principles, we talk about having a definite purpose in life when you know what you're created here to do. You found that while you were there among other people that faced challenges you'd never heard of every day, right?
Yeah. So So to give you some context, the whole reason that I went to Kenya in the first place is, you know, I graduated university and gotten out into the real world and was really disappointed with the direction of my life. You know, I had a great paying job. I had all the things that society and the world told me that I needed to be happy. And once I had all those things, I still wasn't happy. And I thought, there's got to be more to life than just material possessions and a paycheck. And so I was really looking for a job that not only paid well, but, you know, gave back to society in some way. And the job that I was working at the time wasn't doing that. And I had been talking about it with a friend of mine who'd been partnering with Free the Children to build schools for his son. And I thought, wow, this is kind of cool. And he invited me to go to Kenya with him to build a school. And you know, my first reaction was, oh, that's crazy. You know, I'm going to Africa where there's all those lions and crazy animals. I don't want to be meals on wheels. Like, that's silly. But, you know, the more I thought about it, I said, well, I need to take some sort of risk. So I went to Kenya to help build a school. And you're right. I'm sure a lot of people would be like, oh, my God, why would you? We would definitely not choose Spencer to be on a team. But, you know, walking on their hands has its perks. I can do a bit of heavy lifting. And what was great is they also, like, gave me a barrel. And so I did the mortar and the bricks. They would place the brick down, and I would mortar until it got too tall for me. And then I would do the mud on the side of the walls to help mix the cement.
Nice.
So, yeah, so there's lots that I could do. But as you were saying, I did encounter a lot of people in Kenya who were facing different challenges than I had ever faced. You know, on one hand, it made me really grateful to have grown up in North America and to have access to medical care and clean water and, you know, education and a roof over my head and those sorts of things. So I did see those daily challenges. But what I also saw in them is how incredibly happy and grateful they were, you know, going through things that I had never experienced before. I couldn't even imagine it being experienced. They were incredibly happy. And then, you know, the moment that actually changed my life forever and why I came to work for Free the Children. Now I'm literally talking on the phone with you now is we arrived at the Free the Children schools and literally 300 kids came running out and circled around me. And, you know, they were pointing and laughing and giggling and talking a mile a minute in a language. I had no idea what they were saying. And I eventually learned they wanted to give me a tour of their school. And then we sat in the grass and they wanted to get to know me. So somebody came to translate and they were asking me, you know, every question that I've ever been asked before.
Yeah.
And after I explained my story and where my legs were and all those sorts of things, a young girl raised her hand, and she said to me that she didn't know something like this, meaning the loss of my legs, could happen to white people too. And that one phrase put everything into perspective for me. You know, I never saw any value to telling my story because it was my life and I lived it. Why would people care about that? But
I
didn't get to really talk to this girl in length, but from what I took from that sentence, she was saying, you know, I didn't realize that other people have struggles too. And I realized that if I could show this one girl or this group of kids that we all have challenges and that's the one thing that actually brings us together as humans, you know, what more could I do with this to inspire other people to push a little bit harder or work a little bit harder or overcome some of the smaller obstacles they've been facing? So I thought it would be an injustice to come back to North America and not do something about this sort of newfound passion for development work, newfound passion for helping these incredible folks in Kenya, but also using my story as a career. I had no idea that was even an option. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And
so
this
that's
where
it all came from.
I love that. And as you said, like, I don't like talking about when I'm with friends or with family. Arthritis almost never comes up. I don't bring it up, and my friends don't ask me. Yeah, they know I'm in pain, so what are they going to do? Ask me, how's your arthritis? Same as it was. So when I started speaking, people asked me to speak, and then I was getting response from people around the world from my website about encouraging them. I was like, wow, I was kind of disappointed at first. I thought, oh, man, imagine I can make money talking about something I really don't want to talk about. I don't like talking about it. I lived it already. Why do I want to talk about it? But there's so many people in the world that have challenges, and they need some source of encouragement to know that other people face challenges and they're able to go through them and still make a positive impact on the world. And so really cool when you came to that realization, because it's an amazing realization, but at the same time, you must have thought, oh, crap, I don't want to talk about my story. Like, come on, I'm tired of talking about it. And so now you're able to use your life to encourage others and raise money too. And this is important and a great project that you picked. Now, so you realize, okay, now I can really make a living at this and talking about what I've gone through to encourage others. So now people are thinking, okay, really good. Like, that's a great purpose. Now, let's talk about Mount Kilimanjaro, because as much as I would not pick you to help me on my building a school team, I would not have chosen you to climb Mount Kilimanjaro either. And that's where I first came across you. I read about this guy who climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, and I think it mentions from Toronto area. And so I was like, oh, my God. Goodness. And so even when I was preparing my list a few weeks ago, my coworker reminded me, he said, remember that guy you told me about that climbed Mount Kilimanjaro? Gotta put him on the list. And so as much as people would have thought, Spencer, you're going to build a school, you're not really built for carpentry, what do they think when you wanted to climb Mount Kilimanjaro, and how did that come about? Because that is mind-blowing for me, really, to think about it.
Yeah, well, you know, after 4 years of being an ambassador for Free the Children and a motivational speaker for MeToo, it didn't feel right for me to continue to tell students and corporations and adults that, you know, you need to fundraise, you need to get involved, when I had never actually run a fundraising campaign myself. And so I thought, I need to join the ranks and do the same. So it just so happened that Craig Kilberger, you know, the founder of Free the Children, had come to me just randomly. We were doing a speech together, and just in passing, he was like, hey, have you ever thought about climbing Kilimanjaro? And I looked at him, like, very seriously and silently and said, no, I haven't. Like, what? Craig, that's hilarious. But the more I thought about it, I thought, actually, this could be really cool. You know, if I could get to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro and show that anything is possible, you know, even though I was told I would never walk or be a functioning member of society, nobody has an excuse. And on top of that, I thought, let's run a campaign. Let's, you know, raise some money and let's give back to East Africa in some way. And it just so happened around that time, you know, East Africa was facing one of the largest droughts they've seen in over 60 years. So I wanted to give back to them in some way. So this was sort of our way to do it. So I got my buddies together. They were on board. They were like, sure. You know, and Tom, at this point, really, people are like, oh, climb Mount Kilimanjaro? Fine, I guess. Like, what else haven't you done?
Yeah, yeah.
Just go do it. There were a few people that were like, oh, that's crazy. And, of course, my poor mother, you know, was about to have a nervous breakdown.
Yeah,
but,
oh, yeah.
And my dad was angry that we didn't invite him to come with us. So there's all those sorts of things. But at the end of the day, you know, we wanted to use it as a way to inspire folks to be like, look, if I can do this, what more can you all do? I mean, anything is possible. And you don't have to go to extremes of climbing a mountain or raising $500,000 for clean water. But, you know, we wanted to use ourselves as an example that, like, look, if we can redefine what's possible, so can you. So that was really where it all came from. And the reason that we did it in the first place was to give back to East Africa and to sort of push society a bit and be like, look, we're breaking down the barriers of what we're told we can do, and you can do the same thing.
But even just from going from that decision that you would do it, like, the process itself, there's training, and it must have been incredibly hard to climb a mountain without all of your limbs. I would be motivated, but, boy, there must have been times you would be a little nervous or a little confused about why you made this decision, but you made it. Tell me about that experience of getting to the top. It must be at one point, like, amazingly exhilarating, but I used to always think about mountain climbers like, it's only half the job, you still got to get down.
Exactly.
They don't come pick you up on the top of the mountain, you still got to go down.
No, exactly. And everybody sort of has their eye at the top, and then that's it. And our guide was very clear about, like, look, guys, and you said it, he was like, look, guys, that's only half the journey. Like, the top is only halfway, then you do have to come back down. You know, we had spent a year training before with a personal trainer to get our bodies ready, to get our minds ready. And, you know, the whole reason that I asked my two best friends to come with me is because I knew it was going to be the most challenging thing that I've ever done and that I was going to need help, which is a lesson that I've learned over and over and over again, this idea of asking for help. So I thought, I'm just going to bite the bullet and say, look, guys, I need you. And they were great. The first half, I did need them because we were hoping I'd do half on my hands and half on my wheelchair, but when we got to the mountain, that wasn't the case, and I was doing about 80% of my hands and about 20% of my wheelchair. So my buddies were not only great at encouraging me, but at some points literally pushing me, at some points literally physically carrying me. At one point, the porters had strapped me in a blanket and were carrying me on their backs. And, you know, between those sorts of things, that's how we got to the top.
Wow.
The most interesting thing, Tom, is what I didn't anticipate is, you know, obviously I'm going to need help getting to the top. I don't have any legs. I'm walking on my hands. But on summit day, around 18,000 feet, the roles were reversed. And my buddies now needed my help. Because they got hit with altitude sickness, big time, vomiting, dizziness, stumbling.
Oh.
I watched my support system fell to their knees. And I was in that small percentage of people where it didn't bother me at all. So it was in that moment that I now had to help my friends get to the top. And so just like they had done for me, I couldn't physically carry them. And it was the first day that I wished that I had legs so I could physically carry them, but I didn't. So I did what I could do. I stood in between them and I said, look, guys, you know, we've come all this way. Let's just do this together, hand over hand and foot over foot. I'll walk in between you, and we'll finish this together. And that's what we did. We slowly walked until we made it to the top. And of course, we collapsed and cried, and we're not afraid to be a group of guys that are crybabies. And we celebrated getting to the top of Kilimanjaro. Not only was it bittersweet for us, just in the challenges, but, you know, to show the world as well that it's possible.
Amen. And you talk about something, another, boy, our lives are really similar. You ask about, you talk about something you came to realize is that asking for help is okay. And when I was younger, this was not something I did. I was bad at it. I remember one time one of my sister's friends asked her in high school, she said, you know, Tom looks like he has a hard time getting up and down stairs. Do you think he would mind if I asked him or offered to help him? And my sister said, don't do that because he's going to go back up those stairs and come down all by himself just to show you that he can do it. And
yeah.
So I used to, that was just a moment of weakness to ask other people to help. But as I got older, I realized people love to help other people. And if you do not ask them, you're depriving them of a great feeling and a great accomplishment to help someone. And it builds a tighter bond between you and friends when you ask for help when you need it. It's not a sign of weakness. That's what people are there for, to help other people. And so this is something that took me a while to realize, that you have these people in your life for a reason. Ask for help when you need it, and usually they're more than willing to give you a hand, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And mine is the same exact, you know, the same exact story. So, and I'm sure I'm going to learn it, you know, 100 more times, you know, as I go through life. But I've started to actively make sure that I ask.
Exactly. Now you have another big challenge coming up, which is, again, something I think is crazy. You're walking from Edmonton to Calgary. Thank goodness you're doing it in early May and not this time of year. And this time you're going to raise $150,000 for Free the Children's Water Initiative. Wow. How far a walk is that?
Yeah, it's about just approximately 300 kilometers. So we're going to do about, looks like 30 kilometers a day. You know, it was one of those things that after we finished, you know, our climb, and, you know, I went back to Kenya for the summer. It was, we're so grateful that we could raise $500,000 and that we're providing clean water for two communities. But there's still so many communities and countries around the world that still need our help. And, you know, Free the Children launched a big campaign this year where we're trying to bring clean water to 100,000 people for life. So we thought, well, let's jump on board, keep the momentum going, but let's bring it to Canada. Because so many people, when we announced that we were going to climb, wanted to join us on our climb. And as lovely as that would have been, you know, just logistically and liability-wise, it just didn't work out. So we thought, well, we'll do something local where we'll walk across, you know, between two cities and have people join us along the way so they can feel a part of the movement, also so we can raise awareness about how far people have to walk for water and what that's like, you know, on top of the other issues that we read about in the media and in the news. So that's sort of where it all came from, and it's me and my buddies again, gonna do the trek in May. We were smart this time, and we knew that we didn't want to do it over the winter. There's just no way, so we'll make things a little bit easier for us, and we'll do it in May instead.
Amazing. Your buddies must be nervous when you call them.
Well, you know what? Half the time,
you may ask them to climb a mountain
too.
Or walk from one city to another. Who knows what you'll be asking them to do?
I know. That's what I'm so grateful for, my friends. They just always say yes. Just tell us where to be.
You have yet to come up with something where they say no to.
Yeah, so far.
So far. And now you're also an author and the title of the book is funny, Standing Tall. So did you come up with that, or did one of your buddies, or did somebody come up with that? How did you come up with that? Because I thought, that's pretty funny.
We came up with it as a collective. I've been thinking about it for a while. Some of the folks in the office had been, you know, sending me joke titles about what they think that I should name the book. And we really liked that idea of Standing Tall, because it, not only was it funny, but, you know, it was also sort of true. Mark Kilberger, the founder, has said, even though you're 2'7", you're one of the tallest men that I know. And I always found that I was always very humbled by that. And so I thought, you know, this could be a cool title. Not only can we make people laugh, but I think, you know, we can sort of play on that idea that tall doesn't necessarily mean physically tall, as you know what I mean? That we can be just as tall through actions and through words and those sorts of things. So, yeah, that's why we did that. And we wanted to, we did Standing Tall, My Journey, because people were like, well, maybe you call it Standing Tall, My Memoir, Standing Tall, A Biography. And I'm like, guys, I'm not dead yet. Like, I'm still alive. So to me, that seems crazy to put memoir. That's something you do at the end of your life. So we wanted it to be Standing Tall, My Journey, to signify that it's not over yet. And this is just a small piece of what's to come or what I've gone through. So
neat. Well, one thing that just came to my mind, do you have brothers or sisters?
I do. I have one younger sister. She's 4 years younger than I am.
Has what you've gone through affected her? Was she great with helping you out? I would imagine someone with your needs, just like in my family with my needs, a lot of attention had to be paid to me. And when you do that, you have to sometimes pay less attention to the others. And so how are you and your sister? I guess when she grows up with you and she's younger, she doesn't know any different. She's like, whatever, it's just my brother.
Yeah.
Why does everybody like him so much? He's such a pain in the butt.
Exactly. You know, that's one thing that my parents were so great at, Tom, is there was never more attention paid to one or the other. It was done equally. And I mean, sure, there were sometimes some physical things that my parents needed help me with, but that's what was so great is there was never a difference between us. The only time there was difference is when we would be out in public and people would recognize me just because of what I look like, or because, you know, I grew up in a small town. So I know I often wondered if that was difficult for her, you know, and it wasn't, and she's never said, she's been nothing but incredibly supportive and she's just a lovely young woman who has really grown up to be this beautiful, I'm so honored to call her my family and my sister. And, you know, she handled it so gracefully, because I'm sure it couldn't have been easy, you know, going out and people standing there and people coming up like, oh, Spencer, how are you? And not always acknowledging her, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
And again, that's what's so beautiful about her. She's never been bothered by that. She's never blamed me for any of those sorts of things. It's just sort of the nature of what happened. And, you know, like I said, my parents are so great at treating us the same. They never treated us any differently. The only time they treat us differently is when we would get into fights and she wasn't allowed to kick me just because I couldn't kick
her.
You know what I mean?
That takes one advantage away. Come on. Just one.
Totally. So
did she like play tricks on you or just treat you like any other brother?
Oh, yeah, of course. We were just like any other siblings growing up, fighting and yelling and laughing and playing pranks and, yeah, all of those things.
But then it must have affected her as well if she saw you be bullied. Because I know someone from my church and his brother is autistic, and he said it really used to bother him a lot on the bus to school. The kids would bug his brother, and you know, what do? You start a fight or you try and talk back to them. So must hurt her at sometimes if she ever was seeing you be bullied or teased or picked on or anything like that too.
Yeah, you know, because we were 4 years younger, we never really, other than like elementary school, we never went to the same school together. So she never really saw that side of things. She's seen the uncomfortable questions and things that have come when we're out in public. But yeah, she never saw the bullying aspect of things. So I'm not actually sure how that affected her. And she went through her own struggles as well. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, I use a number of people, you now being one of them, when I'm tired and sore and grumpy and not in my best state and woe is me. And so I think, well, I'm taller than Spencer West and I have both my legs, not great ones, but they do work. Is there people, because there's not a lot of people in your circumstance where you can look at and say, well, if he can do that, then I can do whatever I need to do.
Yeah, you know, I mean, a lot of the people that I've looked up to growing up have been personal heroes and mentors, not necessarily, you know, so people like my parents have always been great sources of inspiration on those days when it's difficult. I call and talk to them. I had some great teachers growing up who are still my mentors today, you know, not growing up in Canada, but having moved here, I incredibly idolize and look up to Rick Hansen and the things that he's done, you know, in Canada. And of course, Terry Fox and Christopher Reeves and all those incredible folks. For me, it's never been about comparing myself or thinking like, oh, I've got it so much easier than someone else, or I'm so glad for that. For me, it's never been necessarily that. It's been more about, you know, what inspires me and how do their actions inspire me, those sorts of things. So of course, you know, we can name all the people like, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. and Ellen DeGeneres and all those sorts of folks that we look up to now are you know, incredible figures in society. But for me, it's always been, you know, my family and my mentors in my life, both positive and negative. So those are the people that I sort of have drawn inspiration from.
You mentioned two great Canadian ones there. Terry Fox, I remember I was at an Ottawa Rough Rider football game, and he was kicked the ball, the initial kickoff or the starting kickoff. He was in that stadium, and he kicked the ball, and boy, that's not something that you will forget in your lifetime to have been able to be that close and to witness that. And so, yeah, when you look at people like that, Rick Hansen, as he said, done some amazing thing, Christopher Reeves, those kind of people give someone like yourself and myself, you think, okay, man, if they can make a positive contribution, you know, and still be active in life, then push on. What am I to complain about?
Exactly.
Amazing. Exactly. Wow. Well, this is exciting, Spencer. I could probably keep you on the line for hours, but thank you so, so much. And again, remember, number 41, you could help me achieve one of my 101 things. What are you doing in the next coming months other than your walk? That's coming up in May. Actually, could you also maybe give us a website address where people can donate to that walk?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the next few months, I'm just traveling around, continuing to give speeches literally around the world and just hopefully inspire other people to recognize their own passions and overcome their obstacles. So I'll just be spreading the message, talking about the walk and about the Clean Water Project this year and the big initiative with Free the Children. And, you know, right now, the information about our walk will be coming soon. But for now, people can go to the website, freethechildren.com, and check out a lot of the water initiatives that we have there. They can also check out freethechildren.com/redefinepossible and check out our climb up Kilimanjaro. And we just released a documentary that we did around our climb that's also on our website that people can check out as well. So, you know, freethechildren.com is probably the best one to give you at this point. And then, you know, people can check out my Facebook page or my Twitter accounts. We'll be posting updates about the walk and those sorts of things there as well. So.
Amazing. Well, you'll have a donation from me, and I will be promoting that a lot. And I'm also interviewing someone else I think you know, Kyle Maynard.
Oh, yes.
On the 20th of this month, I'm going to be interviewing Kyle. So you guys provide me so much inspiration, and I will be following you closely, and we will definitely be promoting your walk and donating to it. So thank you so much. Your attitude is infectious. Your sense of humor really makes it easy to talk to you. And you, it's amazing when I talk to people who have discovered their purpose in life and can use the adversities they've faced to help other people in their lives. So I know that, as you said, no memoirs for you. There's a lot more years left and a lot more contribution and a lot more money to raise for you to write memoirs as of yet.
Exactly. And Tom, thank you too for what you do in providing a platform for all of us, including yourself. So I appreciate this opportunity. And let's make sure, I'm definitely around this spring, let's make sure we cross off number 41 for you.
Amazing. Thanks, Spencer. Have a great day.
You too.